Well, Shabbat Shalom. My plan was to continue our Thus Saith the Lord series today. We're up to Numbers chapter 8. As I studied this chapter, I really struggled to understand what was going on. Why God was as I perceived it. Why was he repeating something that he had already done? We already have a very detailed description of the Levites getting set apart, and so here we see them getting ceremonially cleansed, and so I thought, well, isn't this just a repeat? And if so, why is it getting repeated? Well, I was thinking about it all wrong, because I finally discovered, as is common, that I was wrong. He was not repeating something. It was completely different. And so this difference really would make a very great point when discussing atonement. That's probably not a good toy. Thank you. It would be a great point when discussing atonement. So I actually started thinking about skipping Numbers 8 and addressing it this fall, but I don't know. I mean, I might not. I don't know. I haven't decided one way or the other, but either way, I did not finish that chapter. I'm not ready to talk about it because I still think that there might be more there, and I just don't want to get ahead of myself. So, at any rate, this week I had multiple exposures to this saying, GOAT, greatest of all time. And, you know, it occurred to me that really there's only one GOAT, isn't there? And that's God. Because literally, he is the only one that could have that designation, because he's the only one that's been around and will be around for all time. So, right? God is the GOAT. Maybe it's another accidental reference to atonement. I don't know. But anyway, it's kind of funny. Now, look, I know that we use this term in our society a lot. We discuss the accomplishments and the skills of people. And as we get into debates with one another, you know, we'll use this thing. We'll say, well, Tom Brady, you know, he's the GOAT. Or somebody else will say, no, Pat Mahomes is the GOAT. On and on it goes, you know, and it's applied to just about everything, you know, every sport, you know, KU's the greatest of all time university, you know, or you know, you can apply it to just about anything, any institution or sports figure or team, whatever. And it's mostly just in good fun, right? When it's others that are just having conversations And you know, we're talking around the dinner table about athletes and things that we like, and we tend to use this term. So I get that. However, I also thought about the fact that, you know, how arrogant it is of anyone who would think of themselves as the GOAT. Right? I mean, there are, you know, great quarterbacks, for example. I already talked about two of them. And if you were one of those quarterbacks, to accept that moniker of GOAT, I mean, that's just arrogant. I mean, there are a lot of great quarterbacks over the years. And so if you accept that moniker of GOAT, are you not seriously just dissing every other quarterback, you know, that's come before or that will come after you? You know, oh yeah, you were good, but I was the greatest, right? That's arrogant, and it's an insult to everybody else in the sport and everybody else doing what you're doing. And of course, what is the opposite of that? Humility. So I turned in my Bible to read Matthew chapter 18, and I'm going to have some comments on it today. The title scripture today is verse 1, which reads, "At that time, the disciples came to Yeshua saying, 'Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?'" Actually, I didn't want to turn there. And then verse 2 says, "Then Yeshua called a little child to him, set him in the midst of them, and said, 'Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven.'" And this is where Yeshua told us that in order to enter the kingdom, we have to be converted. We must change. We must convert from the walking dead to walking in newness of life with the indwelling of the Spirit. So without conversion, we do not make it into the kingdom. We read in Revelation 17 that those who are with Him in His kingdom were called, chosen, and faithful. That's a familiar scripture. I didn't read it, and that's why. We are first called by God. We don't go to Him. He comes to us. He reaches out. We are lost. And it is only through what He does that we have any opportunity of life in His kingdom. But then there's this choice. Matthew 10 here. Yeshua said that for Him to choose us, that we must choose Him. I'll read that one. It says, "Therefore, whoever confesses Me before men, him I also confess before My Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies Me before men," denies what I say, right, hear and do, "him also I will deny before My Father who is in heaven." So Yeshua said for Him to choose us, we have to choose Him. And then in Matthew 22, we read that many are called and few are chosen. Now, He said this to the church. He didn't say it to the world. He said it to the church, and He said it about the church. Okay? He said it about the church. People, a lot of times, don't really recognize that. When we deny Yeshua, when we refuse to repent and follow Him, denying His law and with our actions, then He denies us before the Father. And so we're not chosen. It says denied. And lastly, we see that once we turn to Yeshua and His ways, His revealed laws and all that, that we are to remain faithful. So called, chosen, faithful. Converted. Converted from and turned away from the ways of this world to the ways of God. And that prepares us, we're ready to become citizens of the kingdom. Now, I put all this together on the same slide to remind us of the process of conversion, because it is necessary for the context of Matthew 18 that we're going to look at. Yeshua was teaching about humility, and he links that with conversion. If you aren't humble as a little child, He says, you aren't converted. And conversion is a process of being called, chosen, and faithful, accepting Yeshua as Lord and King and following Him. See, your calling is not the end. It's just the beginning. Being faithful and chosen is the end. So the point here being that without humility, you're not being faithful. You get that? You kind of tied several things together there. Without humility, you're not being faithful. And you're going to see that as we move through here, through Yeshua's teaching. Back to these first four verses. They wanted to know which of them was going to be the greatest. Of that 12, which one's going to be the greatest? Mark and Luke both talked about this particular event. Interestingly, that the both of those events are in chapter 9 of each of those books. But every account of this, they were asking the same question. Which of them will be greatest in the kingdom? It is in response to this question that Yeshua then tells them that they must be converted and that they must become like a little child, humble, in order to do so. In verse 2, he starts by calling a child to him, just like he does us. Remember, he's answering this question. You got to keep that in mind through this whole thing. He's answering this question. Who is going to be the greatest? That's the question they posed. Now, this child is trusting and teachable. Yeshua addressed earlier in chapter 10 that one must be converted, called, chosen, and faithful. And then here in verse 4 says, therefore, in effect, how is this done? How it's done is to become humble like this little child. So they wanted to know who is going to be the greatest. He says to them then, okay, be humble. And then he says this. Matthew 18, verse 5 now. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. Now, I've read a lot of commentaries about this, and people go all over the map with it and get all sorts of things out of it. And I'm not saying that they're not excellent points, some of them. But when I read the words of Yeshua, these are His words. First and foremost, I want to try my best to understand what He's trying to get across. And to do that, one has to keep in mind the context. And the context is the same all the way down through verse 20. 15 more verses. Okay, we're still dealing with the same issue. He's answering their question, who will be the greatest among them? And much of this is actually rebuke. He's trying to show them that what they are asking, that even the question is wrong. They're not to think of themselves as great, but to be humble children. They're called because of grace. Chosen because they respond and chose God. Why? Because of childlike humility. You don't choose God if you're not humble. Further down, we're going to see soon, he instructs them about how to approach areas of leadership and not with attitudes of greatness like they were contemplating, but with attitudes of mercy and service and humility. It's all in the same context, and Yeshua is addressing their wrong attitude of greatness and power and showing them that real leadership is in humility, service, and love, being instruments of reconciliation and lifting others up rather than trying to elevate themselves. So it's in that context then that we read this, you know, verse 5. What is he saying? He just got through saying that whoever humbles himself as a little child is the one that is greatest in the kingdom. And that completely contrasts their attitude of pride and vanity. So what he's doing here in verse 5 is to get them to look at others and themselves, more importantly, very, very differently. And let's face it, you know, guys, we do the same thing, don't we? We do it all the time, and we don't realize that we're doing it. Our nature causes us to rate people. It just does. We put people in classes. We put people in groups from least to greatest. And we do it all the time, and we do it in all sorts of ways. You know, who do you receive? Who do you bring into your life? Who do you esteem and accept? See, the disciples were pondering these things, comparing themselves and trying to judge who is the best. Who's the best at what they were doing? And Yeshua is contrasting that with a whole line of thinking. He's saying that the humility of a little child is greater than the whole batch of you. That's the greatest. And so when you receive, when you accept, when you embrace, and when you comfort and teach and esteem other people more than yourself, you're walking in humility. And guys, when you do that, you're following Yeshua. You're coming into agreement with Him because these are His words. He's telling you personally, this is the attitude that you're to have. And this is the attitude that I have. Being God, I came down and did this. And when He says, follow me, this is what He's talking about. At least in this path, this is what He's saying. When you walk like this, you walk in His name and you're following Him. You demonstrate that you're receiving His attitudes and following Him and teaching. And he's just really wanting them to be able to see their nature, right? And so He's just telling them that they need to change. You need to change your thinking, right? And so after He says all this, then He gives them a warning if they don't. And that's the verse 6 here. He says, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him for a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depths of the sea. Now we need to stay in context when we read this. We're still dealing with the same thing. Yeshua is contrasting their attitude of what greatness and leadership is versus what He is showing them in terms of humility and service. So that wrong idea of greatness and leadership is the cause. See, if anyone would cause one of these, that's the cause, right? That's what He's referring to here, that would make any of these little ones, those humbly responding to God's call, to stumble. Now, we could probably spend an entire series, easily an entire sermon, just on the countless ways that one could cause another one to stumble. You could go in all sorts of directions with this. Certainly, anything we do to cause someone else to lose faith, to stumble or to sin, it's a terrible thing. And so all those teachings around this, they're proper. But we referred to this passage multiple times in other contexts to punctuate our responsibility in stewardship and our Christian example and in our teachings. And it's applicable to all of that. But as we move through this, continue to bear in mind that Yeshua gave us this specifically addressing this evil attitude that they had. And he's trying to squelch that. They wanted classes and levels. They lusted and argued with each other over who would have the greatest esteem. And Christ criticized the Pharisees and the Sadducees for the very same thing over and over again. You know, we read that how they wanted the best seats in the synagogue, and the seats of honor, and how that they were, they were one way outside, but inside they were like whitewashed tombs, if you remember those scriptures. Yeshua is teaching against this lust for prestige and vanity. He's saying that this attitude can cause little ones to stumble. Now, think about that. How many times have people, and I've heard people talk about this, that they have completely turned off from the message of Yeshua, the message of Christ, message of our Messiah, because of the arrogance and the pride that they feel from people that are Christians and that tend to take everything that they know and, well, I'm, you know, I follow Christ and you are a sinner kind of thing. How many people have been turned off from the message of Christ because of that? How many people reject Christianity because of the pride and arrogance and self-righteousness of so-called believers? We don't want to be responsible for someone turning away from a calling of God. Yeshua said it would be better for them if they were killed. Why? Because if they're behaving that way, they're not really following Yeshua, are they? No, not really. And so it would be better for them. It really would be better for them to die and then come up in the resurrection, in the kingdom, and walk through a life where it's being demonstrated to them than to, you know, die spiritually. In the next three verses, he continues to expand upon his point, and I'm going to read all of them at once because I want to keep this context and the perspective of the point that he is making here. He's saying, you know, you got to get off your high horse. You know, yeah, you're one of my disciples. Great. But don't offend and cause people to stumble. Avoid it at any cost. Remembering that it'd be better for you to die now than to do that. All right? So we're going to read these 7 through 9. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. If your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It's better for you to enter into life lame or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It's better for you to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into Gehenna fire. See how he continues to make this point? This is not a different subject. See how strongly he does so by using an almost ridiculous analogy. Here again, we could go way off the track and apply this to all sorts of things. In principle, yes, we could, and we wouldn't be wrong. But this is a very strong example of how serious Yeshua and God take sin. And what is sin? Transgression of the law. God is teaching here the tremendous seriousness and consequences of breaking the law, and that we should avoid doing so at any cost, that we should be willing to put anything away. Even if it's not sin, if it's causing you to stumble, if it's causing you to have somebody else stumble, you need to put it away. Better to not have it, right? Better to not have that arm or that eye than to have it cause you to sin. It's extremely, it's an extreme way of trying to make this point. So while it applies to any sin, remember the context in which this is given. What sin is he addressing here? He's using this extreme example to address this sin that we're talking about, of this attitude of power and pride and arrogance and lack of humility. If you're going to be in that state, he says, well, it's just better to just die now. Just die now. And so then he goes on and he shows more contrast, that these types of offenses, this attitude of pride and vanity, they don't make you great. They don't. They make you less. And he gives an analogy in the physical to explain the spiritual point. It's better to come into life with less limbs and less sight, whatever, than to miss out altogether. And so that's based on what? Based on offenses. And the offenses are caused by what? By wanting to be great. Parading who you think you are in the kingdom, what you know before others, and then causing them to stumble. We can offend with self-righteousness. We can offend with puffed up knowledge, with arrogance and hypocrisy. rather than an example of being humble and submissive to God and His law and His teachings. And this is what Yeshua was addressing. And He hasn't wavered from His point yet, and He brings it right back around. But having said all that, then He says this. So, He says, take heed. Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones. What are the little ones representing? People that are humble and teachable, that are maybe don't know what you know, that you may have elevated yourself above. He says, no. Don't despise one of these little ones, for I say to you, in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. Take heed. See, He goes full circle and brings it right back to the example of the little ones, doesn't He? Don't despise them. Don't think more of yourself and less of them. They're humble, and right now you aren't. And so by Yeshua's reckoning, you got it backwards. By this passage, we see the favor of the Father is on the humble, on the little ones. This is who the Son of Man came to, the lost. Don't think of more highly of yourself than you ought. If you are called, then you're one of them too. One of what? One of the lost. Humbled. And now that you are lifted up by grace, a calling that you did not even initiate, don't think yourself better than those that are in the same condition that you were. See, what He's telling you is that we need to reach out to people, not reach down to them. Okay? Yeshua then continues to show the disciples how He values every single one of those within His calling. That every single one has value, and that they need to view it that way. Let's go to verse 12. It says, what do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountains to seek the one that is straying? And if he should find it, assuredly, I say to you, he rejoices more over that sheep than over the 99 that did not go astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. A lot of times this gets read with the parable of the prodigal son. There's a lot of comfort in those passages, realizing how much the Father cares about us and the lengths that He will go to in order to lead us back into the fold. But here again, there is at least a full message that could be pulled from this. There is much joy that can be, you know, instilled in your heart by thinking about how the Father really, you know, and all the heavenly realm rejoices when one of us wanders away and then comes back. But you can see that Yeshua is using this analogy to continue to carry and emphasize the same point, that the Father treasures the little ones, the humble and the meek. He is showing this that they need to view them in the same way and not think to lift themselves up. And so, as we look back then at what Yeshua covered, we see He kind of covered all the bases that might have perceived as hierarchy, while at the same time showed that all of them were viewed in the same respect. All of the humble are viewed in that same way. Look back and see it again here. Look at this. We just read this. But notice that in verse 10, the angels are there. The Son of Man is in verse 11. And the Father is in verse 14. And He mentioned each in context of getting them off their high horse, clear to the Father. If the angels, the Son of Man, and the Father all look to the meek and the humble, then shouldn't we too? And shouldn't those disciples too? Of course. They should be thinking themselves, should they be thinking themselves better? No. Humility is greatness. And if you don't want to find yourself on the wrong side of things, you've got to destroy that attitude within yourself. They, all of them, are highly esteeming the humble little ones. And we should too. And so by this point, I would hope, I don't know, I wasn't there, but I would hope that the disciples were getting the point. They probably felt pretty embarrassed, really, by the whole thing after he kind of went through all this. And when you read Mark's account, they even started that way, so I'm sure it was even worse after Yeshua gave them all of this teaching. I want you to notice how Mark introduces this whole dialogue in his account of this. In verses 33 and 34 of chapter 9, he says, "Then he came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, 'What was it you disputed among yourselves on the road?'" You know, Yeshua said, what are you guys talking about? But they kept silent. They were already embarrassed about it. As soon as he asked about it, they were like, you know, they kept silent, for on the road they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest. So we see here that they were indeed arguing with themselves about who was going to have the most elevated position within the group. And Yeshua called them on it. And it's clear they didn't want to own up to it. And they tried to keep silent about it. But we know from Matthew that Yeshua didn't let it drop. And they had to finally ask, "Well, settle this for us. Settle this for us, Yeshua. Who really will be the greatest?" And so he grabs a nearby child and commences to show them how wrong even the question is. If they were embarrassed before, I'm sure they were pretty embarrassed afterwards. But back in Matthew, Christ has made his point. He's made his point. They're not to think of themselves better than others. They are to look at the humble with respect, desiring not to be over them, but to serve them. He shows them that he cares for the little ones, the humble, just as he cares for the disciples. And they're not to be an offense. You get the analogy, right? When he says little ones, I mean, he used a child to make the analogy. And he says, these are the little ones. And he's making them think about the fact that, well, they think they're grown. They think that they're disciples of the Messiah. They think that, and so that, no. You're not big. You're not as huge as you think you are. You're not as important as you think you are. That's why we have the admonition in the Bible. A man ought not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think. And he's reiterating that here. Okay? Now, if anyone could walk around and not be an offense, then there'd be no offenses, right? He's saying, don't offend these little ones. Well, if you could walk around and not be an offense, there'd be no offenses. But that's not really possible in this fallen world, is it? The attitude these men were displaying by arguing would be who would be the greatest. Well, that is an offense. That's an offense. As I talked about earlier, if you're Tom Brady and you say, "I'm the greatest of all time," isn't that offending every other quarterback that's ever lived? He's just thumbing his nose saying, I'm not saying Tom Brady is saying that. And there's a lot of people that say that about him. I don't know if he's ever said it about himself. So I'm not trying to throw him under the bus. I'm just trying to make a point, right? That's offensive, isn't it? And so we live in a world where there's just lots of offenses. The attitude these men were displaying by arguing who would be the greatest is an offense. And Yeshua has masterfully covered that with him. Now he switches over to do to talk about what to do when offenses occur. So he's saying, you know, this can be offenses. Well, don't let it be on you. So now he's going to go into, okay, this is what you do when offenses do occur. Because remember, these guys were in a dispute. Obviously, each one of them thought in some way that they were going to be greater than the others. And he ended their dispute by teaching them that the basis of their dispute was wrong. So now they know not to be an offense. We're not to be an offense. We're not to be offensive to other people. But again, we live in this fallen world where there's going to be offenses. And we read, woe to those. We read that, okay, there's going to be offenses, but woe to him by whom the offenses come. And so he's going to start talking about that, but we're still in this same context. It all goes together. And so how do they handle conflict then? How do you handle it? Because they won't always have Yeshua right there to, you know, resolve them for them. So Christ uses this opportunity to teach them about dispute resolution. And we're going to continue that here in verse 15, where he says, moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you've gained your brother, but he will not hear. Take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or more witnesses or three witnesses, every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Oh boy, have we used this in Christendom. This is the model of conflict resolution that we have. And I know we've discussed this before. There's a lot of wisdom in this, as is usual from Christ. So he's saying when there is an offense, and what is the offense? It's a sin against you. That's how it's put here. When your brother sins against you. That's a big point, okay? It says sinned against you. Notice that it does not say when your brother hurts your feelings. When your brother didn't say thank you enough when you went and helped him. When the meal that you made and brought to dinner, somebody said, oh boy, gosh, this is salty. Is that a sin? Have you been sinned against? That's not what it says. That's not there. All right? It's not there. Let it go. You hear me? Let it go. Forgive and move on. We don't apply this sort of thing for every little perceived offense. The offense has to be a sin. Someone has sinned against you. Then this applies. But guess what? For you... Sorry, everybody. I probably just gave you a poke in the ear there. What was I saying? Oh, so... the point is, if it's not an offense... That's sin, right? Let it go. Now, if it is sin, your responsibility, it's the same. Let it go. Did you or did you not sin? And God let it go. Did Yeshua not let it go? Of course he did. And aren't we to follow him? So what's this about? If we're supposed to let it go, then why do we go to the brother? And if the brother doesn't hear us, we take somebody else and go with him. And if he doesn't hear, we get it with the church and we start to apply this. What is all of that about? If we're to let it go, we're not letting it go for us. We're letting it go because our brother sinned. He didn't insult our baked goods, okay? He sinned. And so the brother has sinned and is in trouble. He's in trouble unless he, what? Repents. And so he may not have even known that he sinned. So that's the first part. You got to go to him and you got to say, hey, you know, I saw you doing this or that. And, you know, I care about you, right? You need to think about that. Take it to God. Repent. That's what it's talking about. And then if he continues to do it and he won't hear you, maybe you take somebody else. It doesn't mean that you go out and you talk to 15 people about it until you can find one or two that agrees with you and then take those and gang up on him. It's not what it means. See, because if you're doing that, do you understand that you're doing exactly what Christ is teaching against? Because what kind of attitude do you have? You have a, I'm greater. I got something to tell you and I'm going to grab some people. You see, it's all the same context. He's talking about the same thing. When offenses come, don't let simple things grow into something larger. You got to let it go. And you got to think about your own self humbly and think, well, you know what? I've made those same mistakes. I've done that before too. When it's just offenses like that. But when it's sin, it is different. And so the point then is that you're acting out of love and you're saying, you know, I've forgotten about it, but I care for my brother and I don't want him to continue in this sin. I want to restore them. And so the first step, you know, is to contain it. Like I said, you don't need to go out and talk to 15 people about it. Contain it. Go directly to that person only. And then you take it to the next step and the step after that. And then sometimes, unfortunately, you do get to that point that then acting out of love for the rest of the congregation. Do you want that sin to continue in the congregation? Do you want it to begin to affect other people? All these other people that you love? That's why we say to the person, hey, take a beat. You know, you need to go think about this and you need to, you know, need to take a break. You're not going to come and infect us with this anymore. And that's what it's talking about. In every step of that, it's all about love and it's all given in this context of humility. If you can't apply this humbly, then don't apply it. Because there's obviously a right and a wrong way to do this. See, there's the vindictive, well, I'm right and you're going to see it that way or else. Or there's the loving, you know, hey, buddy, sin's bad for you. I care for you. I want to help you get away from it. It's just two different things. And you can walk through these steps self-righteously, thinking you are the greatest, that you're above them, or you can reach out to them and not down to them and look to them in a position of, hey, I've been there, I've done that too. I want to help you. Yeshua gave these instructions to them right in the context of them learning and understanding that they need to be humble, to look upon the humble as the greatest, that their attitude of trying to figure out who is the greatest is wrong. He wants them to understand that class and levels and all that leads to conflict. And the kingdom is to be peaceful. You get that? You know, even when there are conflicts, if the parties that are involved are not looking after their own interests, if they're not wanting to elevate but they're wanting to serve, then every conflict, there is a way and a path then for it to be resolved in love. If we can do that in this environment of sin, think about this now. If that's the picture of the kingdom, now, I'm going to restate it. Picture of the kingdom, peace. Offenses may still come. Not offenses of sin now. I mean, feelings may get hurt. Things, you know, misunderstandings. But when you have two people that are both operating in humility and love for each other, that issue is going to be resolved peacefully. Right? Now, if that's the picture in the kingdom, but we know in this environment that we're in right now, that's not going to happen because not everybody is operating that way, right? So, guys, look. This is the structure that God has put in place on this earth, and it is the reason we are here. That if we can learn how to apply this within the environment that we're in of hate and discord and all this junk, if we can learn to do it against all odds, think of how easy it will be, how prepared we will be, how God is molding and shaping us to be able to take that into His kingdom. You're building muscle. You're building your own internal way of responding to things. That is kingdom worthy. So if we can learn to deal with sinful offense in this life and build that kind of spiritual muscle, then the strength is there from a character standpoint to be able to easily deal with conflict that isn't sinful in the kingdom. See, we're having to deal with sinful conflict here. We won't have to deal with that in the kingdom. And guys, in order to do that, you have to be humble. You have to see the eternal perspective in what you are learning while you're building the muscle to be able to forgive and handle things in the right way. See, you know, when we have to do that, when we have to step down, you know, and there's a conflict and there's whatever, and we have to humble ourselves to do that, to reconcile it in love. Guess what you're doing? You're gaining that spiritual muscle, and you need to be able, you'll be able to handle that situation if you see it inside the eternal perspective that God has for it. And in order to do that, you got to be humble. You have to put the needs of yourself ahead of others, but it goes against our nature. And to circle all the way back to the front, that's why it's called conversion. Because it goes against our nature. We have to be converted. We've got to change that nature. We have to be converted from being selfish to selfless. That's humble. Guys, you aren't the goat. You aren't the goat. And I hate to tell you, you're not even close. In truth, that moniker belongs, as I said at the beginning, to God and Him alone, forever. We are to be humble servants, little children, just like Yeshua. And He is, indisputably, the greatest humble servant of all time. Amen?